It's not often that I get to speak to someone who worked with Kubernetes before it was even called Kubernetes. In this episode of KubeFM, I get a chance to speak to Brian Grant, the CTO of the upcoming soon startup, Config Hub. Brian will share his knowledge about the Kubernetes Resource Model, KRM, the architectural foundation behind Kubernetes flexibility and extensibility. In today's conversation, we explore how KRM's resource-centric API patterns enable Kubernetes to manage infrastructure, reconcile desired and observed states, and maintain interoperability across hundreds of tools and thousands of resource types. We'll unpack Kubernetes' evolution from its early API inconsistencies, the powerful spec and status substructures, and how tools like Helm, Customize, and emerging GitOps solutions like Flux and Argo CD build on these foundations. You'll get to understand more about why KRM is essential for operators and developers extending Kubernetes, and learn how this model shaped the entire cloud-native landscape. Stay with us as we explore the future of Kubernetes, including AI-driven enhancements and the ever-growing ecosystem of CNCF projects. This episode is sponsored by StormForge. StormForge Optimized Live continuously right-sizes Kubernetes workloads to ensure applications are cost-effective and performant while removing developer toil. As a vertical right-sizing solution, Optimized Live is autonomous, tunable, and works seamlessly with the Kubernetes HPA at scale. Free developers from the toil and complexity of setting CPU and memory requests with Optimized Live's fully configurable machine learning-based recommendations and intelligent automation. Start a free trial or play around in the sandbox environment with no form fill required. Now, let's get to the episode. Brian, can you tell me a little bit more about what you do and who you work for?
Hi, yeah, I am CTO at a startup called Config Hub that I co-founded with Alexis Richardson, a former CEO of Weaveworks, and Jesper Jorgensen, who is a product lead at Heroku. And we're just getting started on developing a alternative to infrastructure as code.
Which three emerging Kubernetes tools are you keeping an eye on?
One is, it's not Kubernetes specific, but Dagger, just because, mostly because Solomon is working on it. But it's kind of interesting. The Botcube, I think, is one. It's evolved over time, but even before AI, I was a fan of chat ops and interacting with other team members and also with systems through that kind of interactive interface. Of course, now they added AI to it. Glasscube. I'm kind of surprised that it's taken so long for a tool like Glasscube to emerge. An issue we had from very early on is how to manage what we called add-ons on Kubernetes clusters. You know, I think of it very similar to the package managers on Linux systems, where, you know, you specify what packages you want installed and they install dependencies and figure out the versions automatically and things like that. And Helm doesn't exactly do that, doesn't quite have the same model. So, you know, Glasscube seems to be a little bit closer. So if what you want to do is manage kind of the components that you just want as fixtures installed in your cluster, you know, it seems like that's been a gap for quite a long time.
And how did you get into cloud native?
So I joined Google back in 2007. And after about a year and a half, I transitioned to the Borg team, which was their internal container platform. So I was a tech lead on the control plane side of the Borg team. And then I started an R&D project to redesign Borg because it was being used in ways that it wasn't really designed for. And then once cloud became a priority, the Kubernetes project kicked off in about 2013. So I was involved from since before we decided to do open source and before it was called Kubernetes.
And I believe also in the initial phase of the CNCF, you had a role there too. What was that about?
Yeah, we started thinking about creating a foundation to host the Kubernetes project. And I want to say like February, March of 2015, somewhere in that time frame. And we had an early discussion with Brian Stevens about, you know, what the idea of doing it with the Linux Foundation, and discussions kind of progressed from there. Then once the foundation actually started to get going and the structure started to get fleshed out, it was decided that there needed to be a body of technical people to decide what projects to add to the portfolio of projects beyond just Kubernetes, because we kind of always envisioned, we knew that there needed to be projects complementary to Kubernetes to flesh out more of what people would actually need to manage applications. Those things needed a home, and one didn't really exist. It wasn't Apache at the time, was very heavily centered around the Hadoop ecosystem. Once the technical oversight committee got formed, I put in my name, or actually Craig McClucky put in an application for me, and I was elected to the board. And actually, I think out of the inaugural committee, I sponsored more projects than anyone else. And I was even involved in ones like Prometheus, because Prometheus was created by some ex-Googlers. It's kind of a clone of Google's board monitoring system. So there are some issues around that I helped sort through. But I think it was a good experience to kind of try to figure out, like, okay, we need that kind of white box monitoring. We need, you know, all these other different components to flesh out the ecosystem of things you would need to run a system like Kubernetes. The synergy between Prometheus, which was the second project that we brought into the foundation, in Kubernetes, worked out really well. In the ramp up to 1.0, we instrumented Kubernetes to be monitored with Prometheus. That kind of made other people who are using Kubernetes aware of Prometheus and kind of made it a natural choice. I think Box implemented kube state metrics pretty early on to export information from the Kubernetes API to Prometheus. I also worked on some of the principles of the foundation in terms of how we would decide what projects to bring in, the idea of the sandbox, so we could bring in more nascent projects. I co-authored the new definition of what cloud native was for the foundation, based on my experience from Google's intro ecosystem and kind of what was required in that sort of dynamic infrastructure environment.
And, you know, very few people started their career in cloud native. What were you before cloud native?
Before cloud native, I was mostly a systems kind of person. I worked on operating systems, networking, supercomputing, compilers for many years. I worked on three different dynamic compilers, and high performance computing on GPUs way too early.
You know, you've seen this since its infancy in the Kubernetes ecosystem, moves very, very quickly. How do you stay updated with all the changes that are going on? What resources have worked best for you when it comes to staying on top of things? Blogs, podcasts, what works best?
Blogs and podcasts both work pretty well for me. I have some kind of Google alerts set up for certain keywords, so I get notified every day of new content. Now that I'm posting to Medium, I also glance through Medium articles. The thing that I really like about blog posts is that a lot of times they're pretty concrete, so I get an understanding of how people use these systems and perceive them, and their understanding of the concepts and the mechanisms. So as a person who's more of a builder rather than a user, that's helpful for me to see the user perspective. The podcasts are pretty useful, both just audio and video, because I can listen to them while doing other things. So it's helpful for just time utilization for that sort of thing. So the so I find both of those pretty useful.
And if you could go back in time and share one career tip with your younger self, what would it be?
I think get to know yourself. Take time to pay attention to that. I think, you know, it can help you better understand what you like, what you don't like, what are your bad habits, what you're good at, what you're not good at. So, you know, I think that can, if you sort of wait until life events make you realize that, you know, sometimes it can be too late. So
definitely agree. Never too early to start. In terms of our topic for today, as part of our monthly content discovery and Learn Kubernetes, we found this series that you've been writing, Infrastructure as Code and Declarative Configuration. From it, we selected a couple of different articles for today's episode. To start out, can you explain Kubernetes Resource Model, or KRM, is?
Yeah, the Kubernetes Resource Model describes an architectural pattern of the controllers reconciling the observed state and the desired state and reporting that back to the API. And Kubernetes, pretty much everything, almost everything in Kubernetes works that way. Even the kubelet is effectively a controller that watches relevant resources in the Kubernetes API, takes action on them, and reports back the status. So, you know, that pattern turned out to be very extensible and robust. The model also describes the standardized structure and behavior of the Kubernetes API operations on the resources, including, you know, all the mechanisms like resource types, names, labels, and spec and status in particular for that controller model. The details of the API are more described in the API convention document, but the Kubernetes resource model kind of describes it at a higher level, like what the purpose of the model was and how it was intended to be utilized in the system.
And why did you coin a new term for KRM?
At the time, there were a lot of people and even teams within Google who were building or trying to build new controllers for Kubernetes. The custom resource definitions were relatively new, and people were exploring what they can do with them and trying to use that extension mechanism. And we had been trying to explain the model to contributors, you know, just sort of individually, one-on-one. And there was the original operator document, but the principles of the system weren't very well documented. So we wanted to make it easier, and obviously to spend less time explaining it to multiple people. But we also wanted these teams to avoid pitfalls so that the operators and their CRDs would work as intended with all the client-side tooling like kubectl, but also all the other declarative tools like Helm. We were starting on the KubeBuilder project around the same time to actually provide a framework for building operators, but there seemed to be a need to explain the model in more detail so that these teams could avoid common mistakes and sort of understand at a high level how they should approach it. The term used at the time was Kubernetes-style API, and that was focusing attention a lot on the operations rather than the resources. And that was sort of leading people astray, especially the Google teams, since Google's APIs were all built with RPC. That operation-centric model was mostly what people understood and how they approached the problem, and that wasn't really going to enable them to build the operators in the right way, since the operators just purely interact through the resources stored in the system. There is a place for that more operation style API. An example is OpenAI's chat completion API, where you send a request with some parameters and you receive back a result, and it's kind of stateless, right? But for the Kubernetes model, it's all centered around these objects, the resources. And they don't, for the most part, controllers don't interact directly through other types of APIs. So, you know, you kind of needed to establish the right mental model and also explain details of the mechanism, like what when a resource creation request, for example, is received, it goes through a sequence of very specific stages, like authorization and admission control and defaulting and version conversion and things like that. And that actually at the time wasn't really documented anywhere. You had to go read through the API server code to understand that.
Now, it sounds like KRM has evolved significantly. I've heard there was a major overhaul of the Kubernetes API before version 1.0. Can you tell us more about this overhaul and what motivated it?
When we open sourced Kubernetes, and the API was effectively just the API from the prototype, and it was really an alpha quality API. It wasn't consistent at all. I think the only pod had a current state field, and it was actually structurally identical to the desired state field, and just different parts of the structure were populated in the desired state and the current state. Now it's really confusing. That clear definition of desired state versus observed state wasn't really present across the other resource types. And originally, I think there was just pod, replication, controller, and service were the only three types. There wasn't even a node type originally. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to support bulk operations in the CLI. I knew we wanted to have a declarative model that was based on the serialization of the resources. So we needed to have that clear structure. We were also on this ramp towards 1.0. And we knew we wanted to have a stable API. So if we were going to make any significant changes, non-backward compatible changes, we wanted to do that before 1.0. So as part of that, we were just cleaning up the architecture. There wasn't a clear control plane when we actually open sourced Kubernetes, again, because it was just kind of whatever code we had from the prototype. And there were things like the API server would call out to the kube down to the node to get state about the pods and the nodes and things like that synchronously when you made an API call to the API server. So we needed to implement a way for the controllers to report status back, so that interaction could be asynchronous. So all these sorts of factors, we looked at what the API really needed to be, both for the clients, both for the kind of end-user clients and also for the controllers, which were a different kind of client. Clayton Coleman kind of took up the task of pulling together a set of issues that was accumulating and starting a proposal for the API cleanup. And Clayton, Tim Hawken, and I iterated on that. And it turned out really well. We made very few changes between V1 Beta 3 and V1. The V1 Beta 2 was actually created as just a copy of V1 Beta 1, because we also added API versioning as part of the changeover from V1 Beta 1 to V1 Beta 3. So V1 Beta 2 was just purely a test of the versioning mechanism itself. And Daniel Smith built that.
It sounds like that was, you know, quite a significant change. How does this consistency in the API format specifically benefit developers and tools in the Kubernetes ecosystem?
Well, I think there are a couple of different dimensions to that. One is to implement an API client to interact with one resource is pretty straightforward. We have something called the dynamic client, simple.go. which is about a page of code per operation, create, update, get, and delete. And it's pretty understandable. It's pretty simple. It's a simple HTTP API. So that, for example, made it easier to implement clients in other languages other than Go. And we had, early on, I wanted there to be a mechanical description of the API to facilitate that as well. Initially, I hand wrote a description of the API in RAML. And then it seemed like Swagger was becoming more popular. And also I found a REST API framework, Go RESTful, that would generate the Swagger B2 automatically at the time. So I integrated that into the API server so I could get out of the business of writing the description by hand. And then eventually we did use the Swagger to generate clients in other languages like Python. The individual operations for an individual resource are simple, but the real power comes when you want to operate on multiple resource types. Even among the built-in resource types in Kubernetes now, there's, I don't know, probably a few dozen. But with taking the custom resource types, custom resource definitions into account, there's more than 10,000 out there in unique types in the ecosystem. So that kind of diversity of types would be impossible for the clients to support if they weren't completely uniform. So the Kubernetes API is kind of unique in that it has a completely uniform structure across different resource types. So you can just use that simple dynamic client for arbitrary resource types. And then if you want to integrate with the Kubernetes API, it's basically constant work instead of linear work in the number of resource types. You know, there are some clients like controllers that interact with a very small number of types, you know, like the Kubelet interacts with just pod and node types pretty much. You know, there's maybe a couple, few others now, config maps and secrets and whatnot, but, you know, it's a handful of types, but kubectl interacts with arbitrary types. It works with the built-in types. It works with CRDs. And it would be impossible to build that sort of client without this type of uniformity.
I can see that consistency here would probably be beneficial. The article also mentions that Kubernetes doesn't require fat client libraries like Terraform providers, especially with server-side apply. Can you explain the difference and what advantages it brings?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much related to the issue I was just discussing. The Terraform has a plugin framework for the so-called Terraform providers, and that plugin framework enables you to implement on the client side those standard operations, create, update, delete, and get. So if every resource type has different operations that, you know, may have different REST paths or require different parameters or have different endpoint structures. There's like all kinds of different characteristics that can be different. You know, if those things are different, then you end up having to write that by hand and you lose that ability to easily write one of these generic clients. You have to hand integrate these operations, you know, the create, update, delete, and get for each individual resource type. So if you have like 500 or 1,000 resource types, like in the case of the cloud providers, or 10,000 resource types in the case of Kubernetes, you know, that would just be an immense amount of work. It would be sweet decades of work, engineer decades of work. So having a thin client that you can, that can work against these kind of uniform resource APIs drastically reduces the amount of work, not by like a factor of 2 or a factor of 10, but, you know, it's constant time instead of linear time. So, you know, it can make it feasible to implement a client in a day or a week, depending on how complicated of a client you're building, as opposed to, you know, years. So the you know, as a result of the complexity of the cloud APIs and the inconsistency in the cloud APIs, the integrating new infrastructure as code tools with those APIs is an almost insurmountable task. So that's why you see new tools like Pulumi support using the existing Terraform providers that have already been written, because that's effectively a de facto standard CRUD library for these APIs. Server-side apply was the what apply does is it diffs the previous desired state and the new desired state and constructs a patch to send to the API server effectively. And that doing the diff and constructing the patch requires knowledge of the schema of the resource type. There are structures within the Kubernetes APIs, and not just Kubernetes APIs, other APIs as well. Things like what I call associative lists, where the list elements aren't strictly ordered, but you need to match them up based on properties within the list elements, or unions, things like that. Those things are not expressible in JSON directly. And you know, they're not even necessarily all currently expressible using OpenAPI. So kubectl apply originally had, and still does most likely, have hard-coded kind of knowledge of those structures and how it should diff and merge different substructures of the resources. So that effectively, you know, created this client-side code, so we lost that complete uniformity of just the simple CRUD operations. But server-side apply took that knowledge and moved it to the server side. So that could make your client simple again, and you could basically just do apply and let the server figure out the differences. And that and it unblocked clients not only in other languages, like Spinnaker is written in Java, and that uses server-side apply, but it also simplified integration, like integrating the kubectl code to do that was pretty cumbersome. So even for a client written in Go, like the HashiCorp Terraform plugins, it is pretty difficult. So Terraform ended up utilizing server-side apply in its Kubernetes provider, the generic manifest resource type in Terraform. And that's what enabled CRDs to be applied with Terraform, for example.
You mentioned that Kubernetes resources are self-describing at rest. How does this feature complement the server-side approach, and what advantages does it offer?
So Kubernetes uses the wire format of the API resources for all serialization cases. It uses it, or at least originally used it, for storing the resources in etcd. It uses it in kubectl, if you want to do kubectl create-f and specify, you know, deployment.yaml, or eventually kubectl apply. You can apply a whole directory of YAML files containing API resources. In order to do that, you need enough information that you can actually construct the API calls. So you need all of the parameters that would be in the REST path. For instance, like the API version, the type, the resource name, the namespace. So we decided to make the resource representation include all that information, even though it seems redundant with the REST type. So if you serialize the resources to disk or an etcd or for disaster recovery or for whatever, you could read the resource and understand what the API endpoint was that you need to call to operate on that resource. And that was really convenient and really powerful. That way, you know, people using declarative tools or implementing a client wouldn't have to learn two different concepts. It means we didn't have to design kind of an envelope structure to wrap the resource to include that additional information. The, you know, a lot of other APIs don't have this property. So if you serialize the resources in an asset inventory system, then it does need to have this kind of envelope where it specifies that additional information. Or like in the case of Terraform, it glues together multiple pieces of information in the plugins. Like there's provider information and resource attributes, and figures out what, how to call the APIs. So it's very ad hoc. And again, we kind of wanted a consistent mechanism so we can do these bulk operations based on serialized representations of the resources. And it also makes all the operations symmetric, which again makes clients simpler. So like it's not the case that get and put have different structures of the resources, for example. It's entirely consistent. So with some APIs, like the create body will be different from the get body. And that's just a real nuisance if you want to do a get diff and update or something like that. Updates in particular are very inconsistent across a lot of APIs. So having something like server-side apply where you can just do a consistent operation and the server figures out how to perform the update is drastically simplified for clients.
It seems like this self-describing nature has had a significant impact on the Kubernetes ecosystem. And how has it influenced the development of configuration management tools?
From very early on, PR 1007, I described a model for how tools could be built on top of the serialized resource representation. And that was before pretty much any tools had been implemented. You know, as before Helm v1. And so that both kind of helped us understand where we wanted to go with the API and the v1 data 3 API overall, but it also let the ecosystem know how they should think about building these tools. And, you know, very soon we did see a pretty big diversity of tools. People could build tools using whatever languages or mechanisms they're familiar with. They could use MSUPST, SED, or Jinja to just replace values in the resources. They could use domain-specific languages like JSONnet, StarLark, DALL, or whatnot. They could use existing tools that they already were familiar with, like Ansible. You know, we saw people using general-purpose languages pretty early on to generate resources or templating systems from their favorite language. Like, you know, Helm used Go templates, but other people used ERB and built tools that way. So it really lowered the barrier for people to kind of get started with tools they're already familiar with as they were migrating with Kubernetes. And it created this clean separation between the kind of the templating or resource generation step and the apply step. And that just made it a lot easier to build these tools as opposed to Terraform, which had this sort of heavyweight framework, both the client side plugins and also the orchestrator.
Now, you've been observing and navigating the space for quite a while now. You originally wrote about this in 2017, but how have Kubernetes configuration tools evolved since then?
Yeah, 2017, when I wrote that original article, I was also coming up with the idea for behind Customize. So Customize was created after I wrote that, and that eventually became the second most popular tool after Helm. Helm matured quite a bit. They developed V3, and V3 really addressed a lot of the kind of common Helm user pain points. And the chart ecosystem really exploded. We worked together with the Helm community to create the community chart repo. And that was really a deliberate effort. You know, if we looked at other systems, like, I mean, Terraform was pretty new at the time, but you know, the other tools like Chef, Supermarket, or I think Puppet Forge, Ansible Galaxy, DCOS Universe, you know, there are all these, or Docker Hub had, you know, easy ways to get packages of applications that you could install and run. And in order for Kubernetes to be successful, we would need that. So we decided, you know, Helm was kind of the most prevalent tool in that category. In 2017, there were quite a number of users of domain-specific languages like JSONNet and Starlark. And I think, you know, over time, there have been new languages developed, quite a few new languages, actually. Q, Pickle, KCL. I don't see too many tools using Starlark anymore, maybe because Starlark is a Python dialect, and there are a lot more tools now that use full general-purpose languages like Python, like CDKS and Pulumi. Data is hard to come by, so it's hard to tell how popular those tools are, but certainly there seems to be quite a bit of interest in those tools. The entire GitOps category of tools emerged shortly after I wrote that. WeWorks launched Flux, which I think was one of the earliest tools. There was an earlier one, the Cube Applier from Box, I think was, I don't know, a similar time. And then like a year later, Argo CD was open sourced. Those tools are kind of at a higher level. They're not, you know, they don't define configuration formats themselves. They are controllers that effectively deploy configuration of some existing tool or format, like how typically Helm or Customize. Since server-side apply was created, Terraform and I think probably Pulumi both leverage server-side apply to integrate into those infrastructure's code tools. So people from who use those tools for provisioning their infrastructure can also use it for managing resources inside Kubernetes. I don't know how many users actually do that, but CDKS is kind of in that category as well, which is kind of an extension of the AWS CDK. So if they use the AWS CDK for AWS resources, they can use the same patterns for their Kubernetes resources. The Compose tool, I think, is also sort of in that category where it comes from and it helps people from an adjacent ecosystem. People use Docker Compose, generate resources to deploy to Kubernetes. That one we specifically created to facilitate either using Docker Compose in development and moving it to Kubernetes for production, or migrating to Kubernetes from Docker. There's been quite a bit of consolidation. Like, a lot of the tools people were experimenting with are just developing their own tools. Most of those tools are no longer maintained, at least not in the open source. You know, I think the other tools just became mature enough that people didn't feel the need to build their own as much. But there still are new tools like Timoni, which uses Qwing as the configuration format.
You know, the subject of YAML and Helm have come up a few times in this conversation we're having. We've had several guests in the podcast that have expressed their frustrations with configuration tools in YAML. One of them, Jacko, compared Helm to PHP. And another guest we had, Alexander, suggested that templating Helm as string isn't necessarily the best idea. To put it mildly, he said it in a different way. Are we reaching a point where the solution that worked in, let's say, 2017 are not necessarily working right now?
I think nothing has really changed there. The weaknesses of the Layer and Go templates on top of YAML existed from the beginning. It seemed to be somewhat more approachable than some of the other domain-specific languages for most users, for example. So nothing's really new there. I think there could be ways that YAML can be described or written that would make some of those things a little bit less error-prone. It still seems to be a matter of preference. More or less, I mean, Helm V2 existed before almost all the other alternative tools were created. And yet it still continues to be the most popular tool as far as I can tell. So I think there have always been people who preferred some other approach, whether it was a different templating mechanism or a domain-specific language or a general-purpose language. But really it seems to be mostly a matter of a preference. For the most part, Helm works. And for what people do with it, for the off-the-shelf Helm charts, where they are parameterizing pretty much every attribute, I don't think would be a lot prettier in any other language. So I don't know how much difference that makes.
Looking ahead, do you see room for new tools or approaches in the Kubernetes configuration space? And what might drive adoption of new solutions?
I think it depends on which part of the chart. The Helm chart ecosystem is very sticky, and that creates a very high bar for any other tools that are trying to serve a similar purpose. Pretty much all the tools, all the alternatives to Helm, like the JSON and Starlark-based tools in the earlier days, or now QLang, Pickle, KCL and whatnot, or, CDKS and Pulumi for general purpose languages. A lot of them focus on user applications instead of off the shelf components like cert manager and Prometheus operator and things like that. Because, those off the shelf components have Helm charts, and, getting the producer of that software to also include some other format other than just plain Kubernetes YAML is kind of an uphill battle. So, most people would use Helm to at least install those off-the-shelf components, even though they might use some other tool to deploy their own applications. So I think that's where there continues to be kind of experimentation and development there. After Helm and Customize, the most popular tools are tools from these adjacent ecosystems like CDKS and Compose. It's hard to get good numbers on tools like Terraform and Pulumi, but presumably there are some users of those tools that use them on Kubernetes. I think something interesting that we're starting to see now is the LLMs doing configuration generation. The LLMs are trained on public data, and Kubernetes has a lot of public YAML. I haven't tried it with Helm charts, so I have no idea how well or poorly that works. But for regular Kubernetes YAML, it seems to be pretty decent. Any of the models, just because there's so much content available. New tools, it'll be interesting to see how the models can be utilized for some sort of new syntax when they don't have a lot of examples. So I think that's kind of a new area of exploration.
It's an intriguing perspective on future developments. To wrap up, are there any specific areas you think that KRM itself could be enhanced or improved?
Yeah, I think the biggest omission to KRM is a lack of a standard universal status indicator. We originally had an operation API, kind of inspired by Google Cloud's operations API, where you perform an operation, and if it's asynchronous, You get back a handle you can use to query the status. There were a couple of reasons we eliminated that, and some were mechanical, like creating a list of operations for every resource type in a standard way was kind of cumbersome, but also the way Kubernetes works, it just persists the resource immediately in etcd, and then the controllers asynchronously operate on it. So if we declared operation success at the time the resource was persisted, you know, there wasn't really much point to it. You get back the HTTP response and it tells you if that level had succeeded or failed. But, you know, since the controllers are convergent, it was sort of tricky to define. We did eventually define on the client side a pattern we called K-status, because a lot of deployment tools were trying to figure this out. You know, if they updated a deployment, was that successful or not, for some definition of success? And of course, there's, you know, it can get tricky if you increase the number of replicas and you get some more replicas, but not as many replicas as you asked for. Do you consider that success or not? Or if you deploy a new container image and, you know, it doesn't crash, you know, the image doesn't go into image pull back off or crash loop back off. You know, is that enough for success, or do you need some indication from your monitoring system that it's behaving correctly? So we punted on that, and then, you know, eventually, but by the time we created CRDs and whatnot, we didn't have a standard there. So, that was kind of unfortunate, because you can apply a directory of arbitrary resource types, you know, dozens of different CRDs and whatnot, then it will just work. But figuring out whether it worked or not is kind of tricky. So I do think that is an area that's kind of deserving of more work. And I do think something could be, you know, especially for the built-in types, something could be standardized even at this point. And then, you know, putting forth the recommendation from people building operators, I think would be useful for the whole ecosystem.
Now, I think you've seen an awful lot of Kubernetes in the last years. Even before Kubernetes was a thing, you were doing it. I noticed that you shared your thoughts on that at the Kubernetes anniversary in Mountain View. So I won't ask you to repeat that. We'll just put the link in the description if folks want to check that out. Instead, we'd like to know more about the story behind the people that made a difference to the project during those years. Is there anyone in particular that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Yeah, I'd like to give a shout out to the folks from Red Hat who worked with us pretty early on. I think Clayton Coleman's sent PRs to Kubernetes within about a week after our announcement at DockerCon. Clayton, Derek Carr, and Jordan Liggett, who were all at Red Hat at the time, made a pretty big impact on Kubernetes, especially features for large organizations like namespaces and higher level application concepts like deployment. You know, the perspective they brought from OpenShift, you know, was really valuable to the project, and having, you know, that some non-Google participants in the project gave a lot of credibility and helped us build the community. So that was super impactful. They weren't able to travel for the event in the Bay Area, so like to give them a shout out.
On a similar subject, how do you see the community evolving in the future? And what do you think is holding it back?
And the project is like 11 years old now. So the software is really large, complex. You know, that makes it harder for new contributors to understand and get started. Also, there's not as much active development, not as much capacity for engaging new contributors and reviewing complex change proposals and reviewing complex PRs, good things like that. So that can be quite challenging to just go through that process, especially with the progression from, you know, writing a CAP and getting that approved and then going through alpha, beta, and GA. It can take a year or more to actually get a new major feature through. So I haven't been contributing recently, so I don't know how that is going, but that has become more and more difficult over the years. You know, now that there is a major new category of workloads, the AI workloads, LLM training and inference, that is really important. You know, maybe that will catalyze the community to focus on making sure that Kubernetes can run those critical workloads, and rather than get replaced by some other new system that is, you know, kind of more greenfield and easier to tailor for that scenario.
And what about you? What's next for you?
For me, I'm focused on this new venture where we're developing a new paradigm for configuration of applications and infrastructure, including Kubernetes, but not just Kubernetes, because most Kubernetes users, especially in the cloud, don't just have Kubernetes resources. They also have cloud resources. And infrastructure as code, and Terraform is the same age as Kubernetes. It's 10 years old. But infrastructure as code is much older. It's 30 years old, more or less. And the paradigm is pretty much reached the point of diminishing returns. So, you know, I think we do need to kind of revisit the fundamental assumptions and do something differently if we want a different outcome.
And how can people get in touch with you?
I am bgrant0607 on LinkedIn, Twitter, Medium, and GitHub. I'm also on the Kubernetes Slack and the CNCF Slack if you @notify me. I should be pretty easy to find.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for sharing your time, knowledge, and experience with us today. I'm very much looking forward to crossing paths with you in person and hearing more about all the new advances going on in your next project.
Well, thank you for putting this together. The questions were really well thought out.
I enjoyed it. We'll speak to you soon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.